Coming up on Golf Today, Victor Hovland survives a wild Sunday in the Bahamas, his double eagle final round landing him one of the coolest trophies in the sport and a spot next to the big cat. Speaking of that guy, the guy, he did more than host and sign a few autographs. He worked on his game and worked up speculation that he may well tee it up in Florida in less than 2 weeks. January in the Sunshine State, and baseball's Roger Clemens will be throwing some high heat on the golf course. Clemens joining us to discuss parallels between the two sports. Give me the ball and let's go on Golf Today.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet.
And hello again, and welcome, Rich Lerner, alongside Jaime Diaz. Jaime, it wasn't the most consequential Sunday we've seen. It was a 20-player field in the sunshine in the Bahamas. But I will say this. For me, it was the most shocking Sunday of 2021, a reminder of the power and pressure that comes with a number one ranking in the world. I did not see the most put-together, got-it-together guy in golf, Colin Morikawa, blowing a five-shot lead.
You know, you looked at Colin, it seemed like everything was coming together. And also, it was somewhat of an easy week, it seemed, relaxing 20-man field, all these things that, you know, you could ease into this. But that number one position, it means so much, Rich.
And it's why?
I mean, well, it's gained importance, I think, as history has built. And we only know only 24 players have reached that. And when you look back on this era, you can look at that list and go, those are the best players of our time. And that's going to be the benchmark, number one. I think it matters.
So you think that brings an additional pressure that a player absolutely feels?
I've actually seen it before this. You know, you've seen it with Adam Scott. You've seen it with Justin Thomas talking about it. Mm-hmm. Others over the years, Phil Mickelson back at Wingfoot, you know, when he... That was part of the pressure. He knew he was going to overtake or come close to overtaking Tiger, and he never did. He never got to number one. Yeah. So I just think, you know, Colin had talked about it. He set it as a goal. He's very good at achieving goals. You felt like, okay, that's the guy who can handle, you know, the focus exactly. that it takes. And somehow it just shows that golf is really, really hard at the highest level, and pressure and nerves take their toll on even the greatest champions.
We'll have a lot more on Colin Morikawa and the idea, you know, that he might someday be number one, but could he be a dominant number one? Jaime has some thoughts on that. With Colin coming unglued, it set off kind of a chain of events resulting in a bizarre and oddly compelling Sunday. Here's what the leaderboard looked like. Entering the final round of the Hero World Challenge, Colin leading by five. And in world ranking events over the last decade, the close rate with leads of five or more after 54 was upwards of 85%, and we're talking about a guy who was number two in the world, Colin Morikawa. So what do we see in this frantic final round? With nine eagles, that's the good, with six double bogeys, six triple bogeys. There was a five chip, as you mentioned before the show, the one that we saw from Sam Burns. There were two left-handed shots, and there were two penalties as well, courtesy of Stenson and Spieth, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. So it was an afternoon of chunks, plunks, clunks, funks, and when Hovland got it going, some dunks as well, Jaime.
Yeah, Hovland was the one guy whose ball striking held up beautifully. You know, Albany has a very, very penal kind of design. It's a resort course in some ways, but if you miss by a lot, you make big numbers. And with pressure and wind, it became, and from the way back tees where, you know, it got to be a narrow test.
And you like that.
Well, I like it for the tour players. Mm-hmm. I think now we're seeing the game progress to a point where players have calculated that if you miss the fairway, but you still have a wedge in your hand and you have a playable lie, that's a bigger advantage than being back in the fairway with a seven iron. Mm-hmm. So I like seeing players punished for inaccurate driving a little bit more, and I think that's what it's going to take to bring out the best drivers separating themselves from the rest. Right now it's bomb and gouge a little too widely, I believe.
And Jaime, as you know, Victor Hovland's a guy who has control of his golf ball for the most part and has had it for quite some time. He won the 2018 U.S. Amateur at Pebble Beach. I remember the shot he hit from the ice plants. You remember that? I think it was the fourth hole. He was low am at the 2019 U.S. Open. That was also at Pebble Beach. Earned his tour card through the Korn Ferry Tour Finals. First victory was in Puerto Rico. The Norwegian likes island golf. Has now a back-to-back winner at Mayakoba. Puerto Rico, and yesterday in the Bahamas. So five worldwide wins between 2020 and 2021. Has the enviable move, has the can't shake me, never stop smiling demeanor. He has the pedigree, as we just saw. He has the power. Does he have enough to be truly great? I'm talking about a guy who wins majors, players, FedEx Cups.
Well, he has the best foundation, which is great ball striking. And, you know, Kevin Casey and Brandel Chamblee have come up with a stat that's strokes gained ball striking, which is the combination of strokes gained off the tee and strokes gained approach. And I think it's a nice measurement because he's a great driver of the ball and he's a great iron player. Now, all he lacks really is chipping, and that's a big deal because, you know, you can make a lot of big numbers, as we saw with Sam Burns, if the chipping goes badly, but he has improved.
Yeah, I just want to jump in here. Mm-hmm. Any examples through history of guys who were not particularly good chippers who became skilled in that area? And
well,
is it possible?
Sure, it's possible.
If you're not innately good in that area of the game.
I think there's more instruction about it. You see more guys go to short game coaches that never used to exist. Jack Nicklaus talked about never really being coached in chipping, and he kind of found his own way to it, but he was never a great chipper, and he always kind of regretted later on, you know, I should have gone to Paul Runyon. I should have gone to somebody that Jack Rout knew in those days. But he hit it so well, and he made so many eight-footers that he didn't feel he needed to chip well. But as we find, the margin's getting so tight, chipping is vital. And if you have, you know, anything that's approximating the chip yips, that's fatal. Mm-hmm. And we saw it with Tiger happening for about 3 or 4 months there. It was really scary, but he got out of it. And that's the genius of Tiger, but often guys don't get out of it. I know Hal Sutton had a long spell where he had a problem, and that was put him in a slump, or at least it was a big part of his slump. So when you're playing with that, you're playing with something that's very volatile. I think Victor's made great strides, and I think his attitude is one of the things that really holds him in good stead because he doesn't seem to get discouraged.
And if that isn't an area of strength, and statistically, you can look it up, strokes gained around the green, he's very poor. He does, and Brandel pointed this out yesterday, he does have a knack for holding timely shots from just off the green. We saw it with a bunker shot at 14.
Well, we talked about that with Colin Morikawa, not great statistically as a putter, but when he's gotten into contention, he's been really good at closing, and he did it in majors. Now, yesterday was the exception.
And Morikawa up to 7th in the world from 9th. Time now to check on the Comcast Business Tour Top 10. Taylor Gooch is leading the way. Gooch off his win at the RSM Classic, St. Simon's Island. This is a player that might be poised for an even bigger breakthrough in 2022. Seems to really have control of what he's doing. Nice to see Matthew Wolf playing some better golf after some rocky patches in 2021. Well, tournament host Tiger Woods was the talk of the week, and it's time now for Tiger Tracker. PGA Tour posting this video of Tiger taking full swings on the range in the Bahamas on December 1st. It now has more than 1.6 million views on Twitter. Remember the first one he posted a couple of weeks back with the line, making progress. That was one swing, 2 words, 3 seconds, enough to get the golfer completely fired up. Tiger back on the range on Saturday, putting in more work. You see the sleeve on the injured right leg. And there he doesn't look, you know, supremely powerful, but it sort of changes, you know, with the practice session on Sunday. In his Sunday red, he is fully suited up as if he's fully preparing Jaime for a tournament.
He's really sending signals. I mean, the first signal was that 3 second swing, that 3 second video. He would not have shown that if he didn't feel like, hey, this is astounding and I've got something that's going to surprise people.
And fully loaded up on that right side, he talked to Steve Sands about
when
his possible
will you
return.
Know, how will you know if you're ready to come back to compete in front of cameras and people?
That's a great question. As I was saying in the press conference on Tuesday, playing hit and giggle golf, it's easy. You know, I can slap it around, hop in a cart, and do whatever. Play 9 holes, 6 holes, pick up, whatever. Hit a bad shot, I'll drop another one, hit another one. No big deal. But playing tour golf and being prepared to play and try and shoot scores against these best players on the toughest golf courses, that's a totally different deal. And I am a long way away from that. And so don't expect me to be out there on tour at the tour level, you know, for quite some time.
Not sure if you know this or not, but the PNC Championship is kind of a hit and giggle, and you can ride a golf cart, and it's a very short golf course. I don't know if you know that or not.
Well, it's short, on NBC. It's short for Charlie.
Short for where I'm playing. I got to play back there with Justin, you know, and I'm hitting half as far as he does.
When you guys played in that, I think you used Charlie's drives, what, 15, 16 of the 18?
Well, he carried me.
All right. It's not official yet, but every indication has been given that he's going to be there with Charlie. They're holding a spot. Tiger has not said no. He appears to be ramping up for something. And he did concede that, yeah, he could play a hit and giggle. Tour-level golf is another matter altogether. How do you see it, Jaime?
Well, I see Tiger sending the signals that he wants to send to the public and to the other players that, you know, first of all, he loves the game and he wants back in. Which I think was an issue, you know, mentally. Was he going to be able to climb that mountain again? But I think he's looking forward to the challenge. And physically, you know, we all expected something pretty severe as far as, you know, difficulty walking. He talked about possibly having an amputation. There was a 50-50 chance or something close to that. And yet you watch him swing and you see loading up on the right side quite easily. The swing looks very similar to what you saw in competitive golf when he won the Masters and other times. And then following through with wonderful, pushing off of that right foot. Now, maybe the force that he would apply normally is not quite there, but the form is there. He doesn't look like a guy who's hampered. He looks like a guy who can play. Now, you know, of course it's a road back, but to start it at the father and son, I can't think of a more ideal place to just kind of ease into things and especially have the wonderful experience of playing with your son. I think Tiger's very well positioned right now to bring back, you know, golf into his life in a way that is comfortable. Yeah. He calls the shots, but the PNC will be a wonderful kind of, you know, initiation back. And then after that, take your time. But he's talked about St. Andrews, and that's a long ways away. And I think the way he looks right now, that's very plausible.
Big picture, Jaime, you and I have talked about this a lot through the years. It's almost as if the normal day-to-day of professional golf is not enough of a challenge for Tiger Woods. He has these drastic, nearly existential lurches where he bottoms out. Scandal, debilitating back issue, the terrible car crash. Can't possibly come back from that. There is no way. Okay, watch me. Mm-hmm. It is what he has done his entire career. A half dozen rebirths is what I would call them. And it is what he is singularly built to do. So there are a couple three-word phrases that, to me, define Tiger through the years. Tiger wins again, 82 times, and Tiger is back. So it's just this combination of mastery and mystery. When will he play? How will he play? And one trip to the range with one iPhone,
yes,
and he can dominate the news cycle.
I think he's inspired by these narratives that, to some extent, are self-created. He, because his life's been so extraordinary, so much scrutiny on it, you know, whatever happens, he knows there are elements that he can present to the public in a way that makes it more exciting, more impressive. I think even his swing changes early in his career, when he left Butch Harmon and went to Hank Haney, et cetera, you know, these were things that a lot of people thought were unnecessary, but it seemed to inspire his interest and get him to a place that maybe he wouldn't have got in terms of his energy, in terms of his determination. And then it's leaded into his life. And it seems that, not to say this was intentional in any way, but one thing's happened to him, he seems to use it as a challenge to rise even higher. And this is another opportunity to, I think, enhance the myth, enhance the mystique.
Always fascinated, as you know, by special forces, with his father's military background, by doing the hard work that only a few are cut out for, right? Yeah. Putting your mind and body through the ringer.
Yeah, you know, complete the mission at any cost. That was his dad's ethos, and that Tiger has mentioned that many times. And in tough rounds on Sunday, how do you bring it home? How do you get it done? And, you know, that's a microcosm, and the macrocosm is life. And he's going to try to get it done in life again. It hasn't been an ideal life. It hasn't been an easy life. But it's been an exciting life. And it's been a dramatic life. And I think he thrives on that.
I thought he was good in the booth. We've always said, if you press Tiger to, you know, talk about, say, the accident, and justifiably some reporters, a lot of us, want to know more. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. What happened on that day? But he's just not going to go there. Read the report is what he said. But when it comes to talking about the sport that he has mastered, he's phenomenal.
He's phenomenal because he loves it,
right.
And it's the place that is his happy place. You know, he knows it. He has studied it. He'd be an incredible announcer because he knows all the other players and he notices all the details and the mannerisms. You know, when it comes to the other things, I think, as he said, he didn't even watch television after the accident, because he didn't want any negative thoughts coming to his mind. So that is why he doesn't want to open up anything that happened prior to this.
Do you think he'd ever consider going into the broadcast booth? We've asked the same about Mickelson. I think Mickelson will be, I think he'll do it, and I think Mickelson will be great at it. He's a ham. He loves it. Yeah. He's got a great mind for it. But Tiger, could you see a scenario where he would do that?
Forget about
what it would take financially to get him into the box.
Yeah.
But you think he would be inclined to do it someday?
I think he loves to have a close connection to the game somehow. And if the playing career is over definitively, I think that's a great way to contribute. Look what Johnny Miller did. Johnny Miller raised the game. Peter Alliss raised the game with their insight. And who's got more insight than Tiger? Who's got more credibility? I think it'd be a wonderful way to close the circle and really give back to the game in a really, I think, very essential way.
All right. So in the next few days, we'll wait for word from the folks at PNC. Is Tiger officially going to be in that field with Charlie? I'd be as excited to see Charlie, Frank, in competition as his old man. And you'll see that on Golf Channel and NBC in less than 2 weeks. Coming up next, the Rocket Roger Clemens joining the show, getting his golf game ready as he gets set to tee it up in January with the stars on the LPGA Tour. We're talking a little golf and baseball after the break.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet. This season, don't just bet, live your bet life. And the Symetra Tour, road to the LPGA. And the RTX Zipcore Wedge from Cleveland Golf, it's what's inside. And by Skechers. Be comfortable with Skechers Go Golf Pivot Footwear worn by Brooke Henderson.
Back on Golf Today, Roger Clemens, two-time World Series champion. He wasn't just dominant. He was at times intimidating, a little bit like Bob Gibson. Seven times he won the Cy Young Award. 11 times he made the All-Star team. He also loves the game of golf. The Rocket is one of several notable athletes and celebs teeing it up in the 2022 Hilton Grand Vacations Tournament of Champions. That is January 20 through 23 at Lake Nona Golf and Country Club in Orlando. But Marcus Allen, a USC legend, Marty Fish, probably the favorite tennis professional who's been winning these celebrity golf tournaments. Larry Fitzgerald, wide receiver for the Cardinals, absolutely in love with this sport. Colt Ford's a good player. Greg Maddux, John Smoltz, you see there's a thread there. Baseball pitchers, they go at one every 4 or 5 days. We'll ask the guy who's with us now, Roger Clemens. Roger, good to see you. Rich Lerner with Jaime Diaz. Roger, is there any truth to it that if you're a pitcher, you've got 4 or 5 days between starts, gives you a little time to put a golf game together like Smoltz and Maddux?
Rich, I'll tell you this. None of the four teams that I played with had a putting green in the clubhouse like I heard they did in Atlanta. But no, those guys are good players, and you're right. You do have a little time as a starting pitcher. I didn't like hanging around the hotel that much. I like to get up and get active, get my workouts in the morning, and maybe go play 9 holes here or there. But I also had a saying that my only day off is the day I pitch. So that was part of the work routine behind the scenes. And then again, if we had a little opening, traveling the country and could play some of these really nice courses like a Lake Nona or an Olympic Club, you know, we definitely wanted to try and get out and play if we could.
How's your game, Roger, and what's your handicap?
Handicap's about a 5. I kind of float between a 5 and a 6, and I love the game of golf. You guys know that, and I've seen you both and told you both many times. I've met so many cool people through the game of golf. Billy Andrade and Brad Faxon and Davis Love way back got me really interested in it. Billy got me playing in the AT&T and the Bob Hope, which is similar to this event. It's really cool when you get the opportunity to play alongside the professionals when it's not like a pro-am or a hit and giggle round, if you would. It's, these 4 rounds count for the girls. Usually on these events, I notice Thursday, Friday, more chatty. You can talk. The girls even ask baseball questions, focus focus questions on how you were able to focus out there on center stage in front of 55,000 people. Come Saturday or Sunday, even with the celebrities, even with the guys that are really good that you guys seen at the top of these leaderboards in these events, they start to get a little more laser focused on what they're doing.
You know, Roger, I was thinking about a comparison between pitching and playing golf, and I thought of the term quality of the miss. You talk about golfers a lot. Tiger certainly talked about, you know, where was my miss? Where could I afford to miss so I didn't err and make the big mistake? And I wonder with pitching as well, you know, when you throw a pitch outside the strike zone you miss, you want to miss where a batter can't have a good swing at it rather than putting it someplace where he can do some damage. I wondered if that's something that, you know, you carry from golf to from pitching to golf, and is that in some ways the essence of pitching?
Yeah, I mean, great question. So it's fun for me, again, to watch the men or women when we play in these events, how they make adjustments on the run. I with the ladies, I kind of ask them, at what point do they become more aggressive? And I see some of these girls going for par fives and two, like I see the men doing it. So I being a student of the game Major League Baseball, I always made the adjustments on the mound. If I kept missing just away on a strikeout pitch to a right-hander, say, and I was missing off the edge, the outside edge, instead of start trying to redirect my arm angle and making adjustments here, basically I would get on the pitcher's rubber, which is about 17 inches long, and I would slide over just about an inch. And then next thing you know, I'm on target. I'm hitting the corners where I want to do that. Same thing that I'll do, that if I start off in this and maybe you're under duress a little bit, and when you're under duress, they say your misses will be to the right. I might sneak over to the right side of the tee box and just go ahead and play that five-yard fade and try and make that work for me that round instead of going out there and getting my brains beat out. So there's a technical side to it, and you're right. You can relate it both to pitching and out here on the golf course.
Roger, I was chatting recently with former Mets pitcher David Cone, whom you know. He's now calling Yankee games. He talked about the fixation in baseball on launch angles and trajectory on the long ball, and said it is similar to what's going on in golf. Some view it negatively within the sports, that they both become too power, too long ball centric. How do you see it?
Well, yeah, I mean, when I watch somebody like Bryson and I start hearing the numbers that he's producing and what he's trying to do, I think you can relate that to some of the hitters. My two younger ones play. Yeah, you're looking at video right there, what he's trying to do. Still staying under control, but maximize his swing speed. Man, it's interesting watching some of the guys on baseball and their launch angle and what they're trying to do now. Back in the early 80s, mid-80s, early 90s, you know, they wanted guys making contact more. You wanted left-handed hitters, say, if I'm pitching to a left-hander, you wanted to stay away from his nitro zone, which is down and in. Now you see all the pitchers pitching guys down and in because all the hitters are looking out over the plate, kind of diving, if you will, to cover and create that launch angle. So it's interesting. Guys are trying the pitchers with their spin rate, and I see and I hear the guys talking about it in golf, the same thing. You know, for golf, obviously, I hit a high when I drive the ball. I think my driver's 9 degrees, and I try and stay in that area because I can actually drop down to an 8-degree driver and still almost hit it just as high. I'm a little steep. I think when I throw a batting practice, or I throw a lot of batting practice to the different level players I throw to in the off season, I create a steep swing for myself in golf. It kind of translates to that, but you're dead on. I mean, it's getting super, super technical. You got to pay attention to it.
Roger, who are some of the pro golfers that you've loved to watch over the years, and which ones have influenced you in the way you've built your own game?
Well, I think, like I said earlier in the show, the guys that really got me into golf, you know, I won the most valuable player in my first Cy Young in 86, and I remember the phone ringing, and I had just started playing golf, and I remember Billy Andrade called me and said, hey, Billy's a big Red Sox fan. He said, we're going to go play in this tournament called the AT&T out at Pebble Beach. And what's your handicap? And I said, Billy, I just started. I'm terrible. I said, there's no way I could play. And he goes, nope, you're going to play. He goes, what's your handicap? And I said, well, it's probably about a 22 at least. I mean, I don't know, Billy. He goes, no, it's not. It's an 18. You're an 18. And I go, I'm not an 18. But he goes, to be in the tournament, you have to be an 18, so you're going to be an 18. And so he took me out to Pebble Beach, and it was four wonderful days. I think I had pneumonia when I got finished. I was so nervous and just petrified out there with all the fans. But so right now, again, I love watching the two dynamics and the little differences between Bryson and Brooks out there, and how they're going about it. They're different focus points. I've not had the opportunity to play up next side of the two, but I watch them just like everybody else on TV. I love watching the Golf Channel, and when they have these certain matches where you can hear what they have to say and the things they're doing, it's a lot of fun.
You ever see a performer quite like Tiger Woods in all your years, any sport? I mean, like you, I guess seven Cy Youngs,
no.
And you mentioned the bearing down the focus. You had that, and I always thought that was, you know, the hallmark of Tiger Woods. When you had to make the putt, you just block everything out. Have you ever seen anybody quite like Tiger?
Yeah, Rich. Rich, the listen to you guys visit between the two of y'all earlier before I came on. You guys were dead on. I mean, his ability to focus, the physical part of it he's going through right now, the mental challenge that he's going to have, that'll be next. And then some of the emotions will play into it, where he'll have to rely on some emotional things to carry him through, where he thinks about his dad, whatever he does. Obviously, I think your viewers can see that he's been able to lift upper body quite a bit. He looks really strong up top. Now he'll just have to get his lower body, which is very important, because whether it was somebody like Arnold Palmer, when I had the opportunity to play with Arnold and Jack, somewhere throughout the golf round, they would relate the golf swing and getting my legs involved like I did when I was driving a fastball off the mound and getting to my left side and things of that nature. So that would be the next step on Tiger. Tiger and I have had a couple of really fun meetings where we've done some things together, and we kind of talk shop about those kind of things, about staying mentally focused. When you hear the word laser focused, that's just what it is. And he'll have to draw on all those things that's made him great over the years as he's getting older to be able to compete at a level where he thinks he should be.
Roger, how much pleasure do you get from playing the game? And is a well-struck golf shot as satisfying to you as a perfect pitch?
Absolutely, absolutely. I love it. I love being outdoors. All my guys tease me because anytime I can putt, if it's 20, 30 yards off the green and there's a lane there where I can putt, I use my 4-degree Texas wedge. And So I love playing the game of golf. And like I said, in these events that we're going to be playing here at Lake Nona in the Hilton Grand Vacations event, it's not only fun playing with the girls. Like I told the guys earlier today, some media stuff we were doing, is that the only thing I can relate it to when I have an opportunity to play an event like this and the girls' four rounds count would be to have Nellie or her sister Jessica standing on the mound behind me at Fenway Park or Yankee Stadium and almost whispering in my ear to throw a fastball away and call pitches from behind the mound. That's about what it equates to. So, again, it's fun for me to watch one of these professional golfers make a bogey and it really lights a fire in their belly, and then to come back and attack the course to try and make a birdie, and just to see how they, really maneuver their way around the golf course.
Roger, I agree. A well-struck 7-iron is just a wonderful feeling. I wouldn't know it, but I'm guessing when you pop that catcher's mitt at 99 miles per hour to end a game, back when pitchers actually went the full nine and ended ball games, starting pitchers.
I was just going to say
about
that, Rich.
I'll bet that's a hell of a feeling right there. And by the way, I don't like that part of baseball. I don't like pitching changes in the fourth and fifth inning. I think, and Cone said this, they need to reduce the number of pitchers on a roster so they don't make so many changes. And I personally would like to see more baseballs in play, balls on ground, because a shortstop going to the hole to make that play is a work of art. We don't see enough of it in baseball. That's my little mini rant on baseball, Roger.
Man, I love it. Rich, you're dead on. And as you know, if you were my pitching coach and you came out to the mound in the eighth inning, I was tucking that ball under my armpit, and I would ask you, what are you doing out here? Get back in the dugout.
We need more of that. Rocket Roger Clemens, have a great time in Florida, and we'll see you and look forward to watching you launch a few big drives January 20 through 23rd at that great LPGA Tour event.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me. Y'all have a great one. Great. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, Roger. That is baseball great Roger Clemens. Well, it was a Sunday of missed opportunities for Colin Morikawa, looking to end his year at a high note. Instead, he was looking for golf balls. We dive into what went wrong for the number two player of the world when Golf Today comes back in a moment.
Very unusual to see with Colin, but the short game's been superb, and suddenly it wasn't.
Yeah, five-shot lead to begin. Can't blow that. Not solid as concrete, Colin, but he did. Not the only player to shoot a big nine-hole score out of nowhere. I'm thinking, what, Jordan Spieth, 2016 Masters, Jaime, remember that?
That was a big one. And, you know, under the radar is Chris DeMarco. He had like a four-stroke lead over Tiger back in 2005 and shot 41, and Tiger made like six birdies in a row. Suddenly he was behind by three.
Yeah, and Tiger beat DeMarco in that playoff. Greg Norman, 1986 PGA, had a four-stroke lead with nine to play, closed in 40. Bob Tway holed from the bunker at Inverness to win that. He had that big collapse in 1996 as well. So this idea that there's pressure when number one is out there, we saw it going back to 2014 with Adam Scott. He had a seven-shot lead at Bay Hill with 36 holes to go and just imploded on the weekend, Matt Every winning. Scott ultimately would assume the number one ranking, but again, shows you what can happen when there is that big carrot out there.
Well, I think it does speak to the prestige of number one growing over the years. I mean, the first one was Bernard Langer, and then it was Seve, and it was Faldo, and there was Greg Norman held it a long time, and I think Tiger validated it beyond all, you know, I shouldn't say important, beyond what it had, I think, originally even been. It was, you know, 683 weeks.
That's 13 years, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, you know, nothing speaks more about dominance than that number right there. And so to be in that company and be number one, even if it's for a week, you've joined a very elite crew. And I think historically, we talk about players wanting to win majors and make history. Another way to make history now that didn't exist maybe pre-1985 is be number one in the world.
Jaime, you love Colin Morikawa, as we all do, but you have some reservations about his ability to be a dominant number one if he gets there someday. Why?
I think of him as a specialist in majors, the way he plays. His iron play is so great. Precision golf, well-rounded, great temperament. Not a guy probably who's going to make a lot of easy birdies on par fives on regular PGA Tour, you know, week-to-week golf courses. And that's where dominance comes in, where you just use power to get wedges in your hand and hit par fives in two. Not that he can't, of course he can, but not at the same rate that some of the players that we've seen become number one over the years, mostly power players. I do think of him more old school, like a Nick Faldo. Nick was not, he got to number one, but he got there by winning majors. He did not win, relatively speaking, a lot of golf tournaments. Not saying Colin won't win his share of golf tournaments, he will. I think, though, it'd be an uphill battle, and he'll have to improve the putter statistically to win a lot on the regular tour. I do see him as number one, not necessarily a dominant guy who holds it for months and months.
112th in driving distance with a full season of stats to draw from. And so here are the driving distance ranks for the top 10 players in the official world golf ranking. And it is worth noting that Colin at 112, which is about 295 yards a pop, is the worst of any player currently in the top 15 in the world, Jaime.
Yeah, and that's what we're talking about. You know, the game has changed. Bryson has analytically decided that through all the statistical work that he's done, the percentage is with you, but hit as far and as close to the green as you can. As long as you have a playable lie from there, it's worth the sacrifice of having maybe a lie from the rough. You know, the old way of playing was get it in the fairway. You know, Ben Hogan, fairways and greens. And from there, you have control of the ball. And yes, you're going to put it in the middle of the green, but you're not going to knock it as stiff, as consistently as somebody who's got a wedge in their hand. And those guys, when they do drive it straight, who are very long, really have an advantage to make birdie because they have sand wedges and wedges.
Yeah.
And that's not every hole, but that is the trend. And I think that's the trend that Colin will fight if the game continues to progress as it has.
In terms of yesterday's 76 and the blown lead, I personally don't think it will have much of a lingering effect at all. He's proven in the big championships, Jaime, that he is a closer, albeit better from behind. 64 to win the PGA Championship at Harding Park in San Francisco in 2020. 66 at the Open. Those are just a couple of examples. His strength is his balance in his swing and maybe more importantly in his disposition.
I agree with all that, Rich. I do think this one will hurt.
It hurts, but I don't think it'll have
I don't think it's debilitating. I don't think it'll but it'll be scar tissue. And I think the reason it will hurt is because he set a goal and verbalized it and thought, you know, this is my pattern. When I focus, I do it. And to see him be that vulnerable, I think will be an awakening for him that, you know, I still have work to do on myself to be a true, you know, nobody is bulletproof champion, but be more bulletproof.
Yeah, we mentioned Jordan Spieth in 2015, the shocking display at the Masters where he lost it and Danny Willett ended up winning. Jordan came back from that as we
he did, but not he would, quite. But he didn't
not
have the magical
right away.
Yeah,
but they're different players, different makeup, I think. You know, Jordan came back to win the Open at Birkdale.
I think one of the things that Tiger and Jack avoided was that traumatic loss. Didn't hit him early in career. I'm not saying this was traumatic. I'm only saying that if you're going to have this climb. And with, you know, it's very rare to not have a setback. And the setback takes time sometimes. I think Colin, he's got the offseason to recover from this. And it was not even an official event. It just was something that I think was a bruise to his confidence and the trend that he was on.
Tiger and the bear, those are two different animals.
Okay.
Yeah. All together. And hello again and welcome. Rich Schlurter alongside Jaime Diaz. Tom Doak set to join us as we kick off Architect Week here on Golf Channel. Jaime, yesterday's final round at the Hero World Challenge in the Bahamas was fill in the blank.
Thrills and spills.
Okay. Yeah, that's about right. Here's the thrilling part of it. Victor Hovland getting the W. Remember, he started the day, what was he, six shots back?
Yes.
Six shots back. Took advantage of Colin Morikawa shooting 41, two doubles on that opening nine. Hovland, back-to-back eagles at 14 and 15. And he wins by one. It's a final round 66. World ranking points in this unofficial event. Hovland from 9th to 7th in the world. Burns had an episode, what was it, a five-chip episode
five
at the
chips.
14th hole. Colin Morikawa, 76. That one you just didn't see coming. And so he does not claim the number one spot in the world. John Rahm remains atop those world rankings. You see Brooks Koepka tied for ninth. However, it was what he said after Friday's second round that sort of put the golf world on notice.
Do you think you can get even better than you were in 2018, which I assume was 2018, 2019 was peak Brooks Koepka? Do you think you can elevate to even higher than that?
That wasn't peak. Just wait.
I was like old Clint Eastwood, you know, made my day. Okay. Between 2018 and 2019, Brooks won three major championships, back-to-back PGA championships, five tour wins. It was 42 weeks as world number one. He's down to what? Last I checked, he was 16th. We'll get the official on that. Almost 91 strokes better in the majors. Best player in that span by nearly 30 strokes. Here's a look at Koepka's major odds in 2022 according to PointsBet. He's one of the guys. He's Major Brooks. By the way, since his final major win, that 2019 PGA, Brooks at the majors, eight starts, two times a runner-up, six top tens. And since that last major title, only two men have gained more strokes in majors, John Rahm and Louis Oosthuizen. So Brooks, bottom line, is there most of the time. The difference is he's not closing. So, Jaime, it's time for buy or sell. Buy or sell that we have not seen peak Brooks yet.
I'm going to sell it only because the standard he set was so majestic. I mean, he should be proud of that. And if it is the peak of his career, it's been a hell of a career already. He won four out of eight majors. I mean, that's almost, unprecedented. Just a couple of players have done better than that in history. And so, you know, Brooks, to me, has, you know, something that is going to be very, very hard to replicate. And besides, he's talked a lot this year about injuries and about how his body's not quite the same and his knees haven't totally healed. And, you know, when you swing as hard as he does, your body's got to be solid to absorb that impact. Yeah. And so I just feel like there's no shame in perhaps, you know, not having quite as much of an engine as he used to have and doing it with guile and doing it with other areas of the game. But to achieve that peak again, you know, I think I admire, and I think all great athletes should have that belief that they're always improving, but I wouldn't bet on it.
Won back-to-back U.S. Opens,
yes,
and then back-to-back PGA Championships. He, by the way, is 15th in the world currently. I interviewed Brooks early in 2019 after his double major, 2018. He had been left off the ESPN list of dominant athletes of that previous year, and he was not happy about it. I asked him why he thought he was overlooked, and he said because he was going about his business quietly, but that going forward, Jaime, he would be speaking up more. He would be noticed, and so here he is. Mm-hmm. The profile's certainly bigger, but the resume is not. I would say talk is cheap, but it actually does pay. He got paid for picking a fight with Bryson DeChambeau. Let me just be clear. I do not doubt a guy with four major championships. Brooks Koepka is a dude, and when he plays majors, he's a formidable dude. Do I think at 31 he is done winning majors? I absolutely do not. But he has to get healthy and he has to get focused, and he knows that. I think that's what we saw in this last week. I do like Jaime that he's taking some responsibility for his golf swing. He's looking at video from when he played his best golf. He's hungry and he's digging in.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's urging himself on to some extent with this verbal talk, because I remember interviewing him earlier in his career and he was under the radar and he wanted to stay there. He didn't feel he'd earned the right to talk. Now he's earned it. But I wonder if it's counterproductive sometimes, because you're playing a character, you know. It feels like you said, Clint Eastwood, you know, this dry bravado that he has, it's become kind of an affectation. And, you know, I understand. It's motivational, too, but you got to deliver, you know. And the more you talk about it and don't deliver, you know, he didn't deliver at Kiowa. There was this thought, you know, and he didn't deliver against DJ at Wingfoot. Not to say he can't, or excuse me, at Harding Park. Not to say that he's not capable, but why bring on the baggage? Just do it, you know? And I think people respect you even more when you just silently are the assassin.
If Brooks isn't going to get to his peak in 2022, which player do you think will?
I'm going to go with the reigning champion, John Rahm, who, you know, is number one and, yes, had an incredible year and won the U.S. Open. But I still feel like he hasn't made the best of his opportunities. He's in contention so often. I think he can become a better winner. I think a lot of that depends on controlling emotions. He's getting better at that, obviously. What he did at Torrey, making those putts, that's going in the memory bank in a way that will always give him confidence when he's under the heat. He's the best driver in the game, probably. His short game is still very good. It's got to be a little more consistent. Great putter. The irons need refinement. There's room to grow. He's young. I like the idea that he took time off at the end of the year here. He missed the DP World Tour. Big tournament out in Dubai, missed the Hero, which he had won before, but I think he felt, you know, exhausted and he needed to refresh. Jack Nicklaus always said, you know, come into the year ready and refreshed, otherwise your longevity will be curtailed. So I think he's playing the long game, but I also think he's got, to me, the most tools to be number one and be dominant.
Yeah, I agree with you. I love John Rahm. I think he comes roaring out of the gates in 2022, and I do think he has a chance to be entrenched as number one in the world. But I will take another player for the sake of this segment that we're doing right here. Though he has not played particularly well in the major championships, my peak player is Patrick Cantlay. After Rahm's U.S. Open, Cantlay's BMW mind blower against DeChambeau was the clutch performance of the year. He won the FedEx Cup title, and in the process, he changed the public perception of him in a way no other golfer did in 2021. From what I would call vanilla flatliner to deep thinker to a guy you have to hear from. As for his golf, his pedigree has always been pure. His swing is solid and reliable, repeatable. What is different is the confidence level, Jaime. It now matches the talent. He is ready to be the guy that he always knew he could be. And remember, he went through a fair amount of adversity, having lost his best friend a number of years ago. He's out the other side, and he's in a great place.
I think his trajectory is steeper than anyone's right now. Mm-hmm. You know, so will he get to the top? It's very possible, because Patrick Cantlay grew up that way. He was the number one amateur in the world by quite a bit, and a real prodigy. So he's rediscovered himself through all that adversity, and he's a stronger guy for it.
Yeah, just to back up the point about the majors, two top 25s at the majors in 2021, but he also missed two cuts at the Masters and the Open. Well, the life of an elite professional might seem glamorous, but the journey to get there is typically anything but. Brently Romine taking a deep dive on the realities of turning pro, talking to players on expenses, raising money, and deciding how long to pursue the dream. GolfChannel.com kicking off a series this week focusing on this arduous process of turning professional. With more on this series, we are pleased to welcome in our colleague, Brently Romine. Brently, what prompted you to pursue this story, this project?
Well, Rich, thanks for having me on. Yeah, there's just so many unknowns these days. I mean, obviously, the landscape of professional golf and chasing a dream has evolved over the years. And I look at this lead that came out today as almost sort of a how-to guide of sorts, talking with players, both male and female, on mini tours, on international tours, agents, equipment reps. I go over everything from the questions players should ask themselves before turning pro, questions like, what do I have in common with the best players in the world? To, of course, stories of how players have traveled hard and lived inexpensively to keep their dream alive. So over the course of the week, we'll also have some player profiles written by Golf Channel writers Mercer Baggs, Ryan Lamner, and Emilia Migliaccio. There's a profile on Kennedy Swan, who just graduated from the national champion Ole Miss Rebels. Another one on George Cunningham, who is a young father trying to make it as a pro golfer. Really a ton of good information, and I'm excited for us to share it.
Brently, what stood out to you in writing the lead?
Yeah, so I go back to that question of what does an aspiring pro have in common with the best players in the world? You know, hundreds of players turn pro every year, as we know, but the majority of them are never going to make it to the PGA Tour and LPGA. So who is going to make it? Looking at the numbers, the stats show that if a player played college golf, they're probably going to have been a Division I player who played for a Power 5 school, won at the college level, and was an All-American, preferably first team, which is really, I think, a future indicator of elite pro success. Looking at the OWGR, 8 of the top 18 players were first-team All-Americans within the last decade. And then I talked about that importance of winning. In the last 10 years, there have been 126 different winners on the PGA Tour who played in college. 99 of them won a tournament while in college. So there's always exceptions, Rich, right? And that's because those players got better, and they had other intangibles like the ability to handle adversity, ability to fund their journey, the ability to take another player's job. You know, to play on the PGA Tour or on the LPGA, you have to have the ability to take someone else's job. And as you know, they're great jobs and people love those jobs.
Financial cost of being a professional is high. How much does it actually cost to play a year of professional golf on these developmental tours?
Well, I kind of had an idea of how expensive it was, but I'll tell you what, I was kind of blown away about the numbers. It's not cheap, and it certainly depends on what tour you're on, right? There's a lot of give and take there. The mini tours, they have the highest entry fees on average, but the travel can be cheaper. Korn Ferry Tour, no entry fees, but you're paying your caddy about $1,500 per tournament. So the overall number really depends. Some players are more frugal than others, but the ballpark is probably around that 50K to 100K six-figure range. Ali Toste, who was a player I talked to as part of this story, he played at Florida. He competed in 32 events and 5 qualifiers this year, spent just over 70K. And that didn't even include general living expenses. And then when you look at the break-even numbers for the different tours, when you have to basically crack the top 15 in Canada or the top 25 on the Symetra Tour to turn a profit, it's no wonder that there's such a sense of urgency to reach the big stages of professional golf.
I got to know young Ali. We call him the toaster at the Latin America Amateur Championship over a few years. A wonderful young man. Didn't speak a lot of English when he came to the University of Florida. He does now. He went back and he earned his degree. I, for one, am hoping that the toaster, as we call him, makes it in professional golf. Brently, thank you for this deep dive. Really fascinating. And we look forward to hearing more from you in the coming weeks. And again, you can check it out on the challenges of turning professional and playing at the highest levels at golfchannel.com.